All right, folks, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Welcome to Torah Studies. This is our weekly. Are we sure? Maybe there's some more down there. Yeah, it looks like there's some more. Yeah, there's some more going around that way. All right, folks, this is our weekly journey into the soul of the Torah portion. So every parsha, every Torah portion is unique and special and amazing. This is my however, but, right? You're with me on this? This is everyone is amazing. All 53 Torah portions are awesome and all that stuff.
But
however, once in a while, you get a Torah portion that has everything. Drama, intrigue, murder, soothsaying, prophecy, curses, blessings, intrigue, scandal, all rolled into one package. Folks, this is Balak. Welcome to the party. This is an incredible Torah portion. It's got everything from A, I feel like saying Z just because I feel international lately, right? A to Z. Tell you a funny story about that, but that's off topic. Torah portion is Balak. Please open your Chumash to page 1014. Wow, 1013 previous pages were also amazing, but 1014 begins a truly special parsha, truly special Torah portion. So we begin, we're going to do a quick overview, and then we're going to fast forward to the end of the portion, because that is where the story that we're going to focus on takes place. All right, so the opening of the parsha is the Jews are marching to the land of Israel. This is after the 40 years of wandering. The decree has passed. The Jews are now set to enter the land of Israel. The only problem is they have to get there. And if you think that you found a good ticket on international travel, you should have seen what the Jews... They had free travel because they were walking. They were walking to their destination. The problem with that is they had to pass through other lands. And not all of the nations that lived between them and the land of Israel were friendly enough to let them pass through. In fact, many of them said, don't pass through. So they went around. Some of them came out to greet them in battle. And this particular one, the king of Moab, the nation of Moab, led by the king Balak, he tried another approach. He didn't tell them to go around. He didn't come out with his army to greet them or to, you know, keep them away. Rather, he hired a prophet for profit. A prophet who would curse a hired gun, a mercenary, a mouth mercenary, who would curse the enemies to their downfall. The prophet's name, of course, was Bilam, a.k.a. Balaam in the English. They decided to change the letter. I don't know why. But Bilam / Balaam is the prophet for hire. He initially is apprehensive about going. God dissuades him. He persists. God finally says, look, do what you want. If you want to go, go. Our sages sum this up with a beautiful phrase. The way that a person wants to go, God allows the person to go. God does not swoop in and save us from our own folly. God does not save us from our own disgrace. God says, look, I'm telling you it's a bad idea. If you really want to, knock yourself out. So Bilam, or Balaam, approaches God. Can I curse the Jewish people? God says, not a good idea. But I really want to. God says, fine. See what happens. So he goes, famous story with the talking donkey, which we're not going to get into. Three times, Bilam attempts to curse the Jewish people. Three times, the curses are transformed into blessings. A fourth time, of his own accord, Bilam, the evil prophet, blesses the Jewish people, speaking about the end of days. Some of the most profound prophecies about the Messianic era actually come from this enemy of the Jewish people, Bilam, the evil prophet. It's after this dramatic story of the prophet trying to curse and the curses turning into blessings, it's after this entire episode that we get to that we get to the main topic of our class. So I see some of you opened up the Chumash. We're not going to read this main part in the Chumash, but because you've opened up the Chumash anyway, let's turn some pages and we'll kind of map it out inside, and then we'll close it and then read in the Torah studies text. So 10:15 in the Chumash, the Torah talks about the fear of Balak, the king of Moab, his fear about the approach of the Jewish people, and his attempt to hire Balaam or Bilaam. We have the negotiation between his messengers and Bilaam. He doesn't want to go. He wants to go. God doesn't want him to go. 10:19, Bilaam's journey. And here you have the story about the talking donkey and the angel. 10:21, Bilaam accepts the gig. He agrees to do the gig. We live in a gig economy. Ever hear that? Gig economy? Everyone's doing gigs. You know the scooters that they have now? Have you seen them around this area, maybe other areas? You can just put them wherever you want. You just rent them with your phone, with your app. Now they have bikes also. I know you know about the blue bikes. This is not blue bikes, because the blue bikes have a stand. And in order to release them from the stand, you have to pay. There are new bikes that they just dropped off somewhere where you can just dump them anywhere. You pick them up wherever, and you dump them anywhere, and it's good. But this has created another industry. This is totally off topic, by the way. I know you're listening rapidly, but this is parenthetical. So now they have people that go at night with trucks or cars and pick up the scooters and the bikes to take them to locations, drop them off. So here you have a situation. No, not stealing them. No, working for it. No, so this is part of the gig economy. This is like the job is to pick up the stuff that people dump all across the city and reposition them or charge them overnight if they're the scooters, whatever. Anyway, so Bilaam accepts the gig. He says, okay, I'll do it. Finally accepts the gig, and he attempts. 10:23, his first attempt, curse turns into blessing. 10:25, second attempt, the curse turns into a blessing. 10:27, it continues. 10:29, third attempt, once again, the curse turns into a blessing. 10:33, Bilaam foretells the end of days. This is number four, the fourth time that he blesses the Jewish people. It's a prophecy about the Messianic era. 10:35, it continues. 10:37 is our story. The story is a Jewish prince, a Midianite princess, and Pinchas. Pinchas. A man who we know today, or we've known for a while, as a zealot. Right? Zealot. What's a zealot? What's a zealot? Pinchas. Okay, so now who's Pinchas? A zealot. So what's going on? We're going to see it inside. Open up the Torah studies text, please. And by the way, today's class is all about the Pinchas paradox. Pinchas paradox, which you'll discover soon. Okay, we are in the Torah studies book, lesson 12, A Zealous Act, text 1. A, page 254. Ray, please.
Why don't you start that side?
Should we start? Listen, Jillian, I don't know. I'm open to it. I was open to it because I always go this way. But if Ray is getting offended, we're not offending Ray.
Well, in honor of my daughter.
Yes.
Here tonight,
Lisa.
And her son.
Ari.
My grandson, Ari.
Ray, you're going to get us started. All right, this is like the opening pitch and the opening kickoff and whatever they do in soccer, which I'm not sure of. Okay, text 1A, page 254. Let's begin.
Israel settled in Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of the Moabites. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and prostrated themselves to their gods.
Remember, this is immediately following the story of Bilaam's failed attempt to curse the Jewish people and his blessing them three times and a fourth time. Right after that, this is the narrative. There's no segue. There's no bridge in between. This is the very next verse. Please continue.
Israel became attached to Baal Peor, and the anger of God flared against Israel. God said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and hang them before the God facing the sun, and then the flaring anger of God will be removed from Israel.
You're probably wondering, why are we hanging the leaders of the people? Hold on. Continue, please.
Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you shall kill the man who became attached to Baal Peor. Then an Israelite man came and brought the Midianite woman to his brethren before the eyes of Moses and before the eyes of the entire congregation of the children of Israel, while they were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting.
Okay, we're going to explain all this, but this is the way it appears in the Torah without commentary. This is pretty much an accurate translation of the biblical text about this story. Okay, so that's text 1a. So what we have so far is there is some sort of immorality that's happening with the daughters of Moab, between the Jewish people and the daughters of Moab. We have some sort of idolatry. The Baal Peor was an idol. So we have some sort of idolatry happening here. We have God's anger. We have some punishment that's being meted out. Each of you shall kill the men who became attached to Baal Peor. Okay, people are crying. And then we have an Israelite man coming and bringing the Midianite woman to his brethren before the eyes of Moses. Okay, let's continue inside. Text 1b, Ray.
Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aharon the Kohen, saw this, arose from the congregation, and took a spear in his hand. He went after the Israelite man into the chamber and drove it through both of them, the Israelite man and the woman, through her stomach, and the plague ceased from the children of Israel. Those who died in the plague numbered 24,000.
Okay, so that's the end of the story. That is the end of the story. A little bit enigmatic as far as what is happening here. By the way, it's not only the end of the story, it's the end of the Torah portion. That's how the portion ends. Those that died in the plague, number 24,000. Up, that's it. And we're done for the week. We'll see you next week.
I don't see where they mentioned the plague.
Yeah, there was a plague also at some point. The implication is there was a plague that stopped. It's not in the verses. Okay, so we have this idea that judges are supposed to mete out punishment and kill those that are attached to Baal Peor. We also have a plague that's implied from the fact that it stops after the old spear incident, right? So that plague stops. So we have, seems like capital punishment being meted out by some, you know, impromptu courts, right, that are just being set up. We have a plague, a divine plague that's happening, and it's taking out a bunch of people. 24,000 is not an insignificant sum. It's a significant sum of people. And so this is what's going on. And that's, again, how the Torah portion ends. There is a lot to the story that is left to the imagination. In other words, there's a lot that's left without clarity. We don't know. There's a few things that we don't know. We don't know why the people began committing harlotry with the daughters of Moab. I mean, we can try to use our imagination, but how did that happen? What's the setup to that? Why were they starting to worship this idol of Baal Peor? Why did the Israelite man bring a Midianite woman to his to his brethren before the eyes of Moses, the children of Israel? What's going on there? And why did Pinchas take matters into his own hand? Why was there a plague? So much is left unanswered. The commentaries, Talmud, Midrash, and other commentaries, classic Jewish commentaries, fill in the blanks, fill in the rest of the story. So let's begin. Oh, actually, sorry, before that, one more text. Ray, you up to one more? Text 1C?
Yes.
We'll give you a triple header. Text 1C is the opening of next week's Torah portion. And here we have God's response to what Pinchas did, this act of zealotry, to take a spear and spear the Israelite man and the Midianite woman. So in response to that, here's what God says, opening of next week's Torah portion, which is named after Pinchas.
God spoke to Moses saying, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the Kohen, has turned my anger away from the children of Israel by his zealously avenging me among them, so that I did not destroy the children of Israel because of my zeal. Therefore, say, I hereby give him my consent of peace. It shall be for him and for his descendants after him as an eternal covenant of priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and atoned for the children of Israel.
Okay. So that is the reward. So Pinchas is not prosecuted for his act of zealotry. On the contrary, he is rewarded with the kahuna, with the priesthood. Now, the Talmud, as I mentioned, the Talmud explains in great detail the setup to the story. Text 2a is the Talmud, an excerpt from the Talmud, Tractate Sanhedrin. It's a long piece. We're going to read most of it. So the setup, so there's one piece of the setup that's not here before this piece begins. Why is it that the Jewish people began to sin with the daughters of Moab? Remember, this is a nation of idolaters. This is not a kosher people for the Jewish people, and the Jewish men begin to sin with the Moabite women. What happened? So the commentaries say, our sages say, this is what happened. Balaam, after his attempt to curse the Jewish people, was thwarted multiple times. So before he took leave of the king who hired him, whose name was Balak, the king of Moab, he said, I have a piece of advice. I can't curse them with my words. It's not effective. But what I do advise you to do, there's still a way to get the Jewish people destroyed by God. And that to harm the Jewish people, and that is have them fall out of favor with God. How to do that? Have them serve idols. How to do that? Entice the Jewish men. Send your women to entice the Jewish men before they commit the act of immorality. Have the women say, "But wait, before we begin, there's this little idol that you need to bow down to, or a big idol that you need to bow down to." Have them commit idolatry, which they did, the Baal Pa'ar, right? And then engage in morality. So you have immorality, you have idolatry, you have like two out of the big three cardinal sins of Judaism, and thus that will cause the Jewish people to fall out of favor with God. And once God does not, once the Jewish people no longer find favor in God's eyes, they become vulnerable to attacks, to falling, to failure, to stumbling, etc. We've seen it before. It can happen again. That was...
Including the plague.
And the plague actually happened. Now, remember, there's a few million people. So 24,000 did not take out, you know, the Jewish people. But the plan was that it should keep on going and it should devastate the people or maybe cause them to be delayed for another 40 years or so. Right? That was the plan. It didn't work fully. It worked partially. This was, again, according to our sages, this was Balaam's advice. That is why it immediately follows the story of Balaam. Balaam is unable to curse the Jewish people, so instead he says, here's some advice, here's how to get them, here's how to bring about their downfall, and that's the episode that immediately follows in the biblical narrative. So what happens? The plan works perfectly. The Jewish men are enticed, and they begin sinning. They begin not only sinning by engaging in illicit relationships with idolatrous women. In addition to that, they're serving idols. And the plague is breaking out. In addition to a plague, we also have these judges who are executing those, capital punishment to those who are worshiping the idols. Idolatry is a capital crime in according to biblical law. So here's what happens next. The people begin complaining that they're getting punished. Here we go. Text, what are we, 2a? Text 2a, Jillian.
The tribe of Simeon went to Zimri, son of Salu, their leader, and said to him, "They are judging cases of capital law and executing us, and you are sitting and are silent."
Understand what they're saying. They're saying, they're killing us for engaging in all this illegal activity, right? All this illicit, immoral, idolatrous activity. And they're complaining that the punishment is coming down on them. So they're going to their leader. They're saying, save us. We want to continue this behavior, but save us from this punishment. Continue.
What did Zimri do? He arose and gathered 24,000 people from the children of Israel and went to Cosby, daughter of Zur, princess of Midian and said to her, submit to me and engage in intercourse with me. Can somebody else continue, please?
Yes, no problem.
It's a long one.
Yeah, no problem. Lisa.
Okay. She said to him, I am the daughter of the king, and this is what my father commands of me. Submit only to the greatest of them.
By the way, she meant that they're saving me to seduce who?
Moshe.
Moses. She's like, you're just a leader of the tribe of Shimon, of Simeon. Like, I'm waiting for Moses. Continue.
Zimri said to her, I too am the head of a tribe. Moreover, I am greater than Moses, as he is the second of the womb, and he is the third of the womb. He seized her by her forelock, brought her before Moses, and said, son of Amram, is this woman forbidden or permitted? And if you say that she is forbidden, then who permitted to you the daughter of Yitro?
Yep. So once again, let me explain this. So basically, he convinces her that he's a good person to engage in this immoral act with, and he takes her in front of Moses and in front of these 24,000 people, and says, "What do you say, Moses?" He calls him son of Amram. That's like, I mean, that was his father's name, but that's still a derogatory type of phrase, right? So he says, is woman forbidden or permitted? And he says, if it's forbidden, so you also marry, your wife is also from Midian. He married a Midianite woman. So what makes your wife permitted and she not? Now, what is actually the distinction? The distinction is that Moshe married Zipporah, his wife, who was from Midian, before Sinai. And before Sinai, the Jewish people didn't have the law and didn't have the prohibition against idolatry and didn't have, you know, various laws. And there wasn't a formal, if we would call it, a formal conversion process. Now, once the Jews stood at Sinai, everyone accepted the Torah, including, of course, Moshe's wife. So everyone accepted, I was going to say converted, everyone, it says that at Sinai, everyone converted to Judaism, all the Jewish people formally accepted Judaism, Torah, mitzvot, including Moshe's wife. This woman had certainly, you know, she was certainly still an idolatress. She was a Midianite princess, and that was a problem. So, but Zimri is trying to, you know, he's provoking this situation and saying, look, Moses, you also married a Midianite woman, so I think I'm going to, you know, spend some time with her. Continue, please.
The halacha eluded Moses. And it is written, therefore, and Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, saw and arose in the midst of the congregation and took a spear in his hand. What did Pinchas see? Rav says he saw the incident taking place before him, and he remembered the halacha. He said to Moses, did you not teach me that one who engages in intercourse with a Gentile woman, zealots, strike him?
And of course, it's not just a regular situation. This time at a public situation that is coming to defy Torah and Judaism and with an idolatrous, etc. Continue.
Moses said to him, let the one who reads the letter be the agent to fulfill its contents. Once he reached the tribe of Simeon, he said, where do we find the tribe of Levi is greater than that of Simeon?
You know what he was saying here? He says, who says that Levi is greater than, who says that the tribe of Levi is greater than that of Simeon? In other words, he was saying, why am I excluded from this? Give me a piece of the action. Continue. In other words, he pretended like he wanted to get into the tent to also engage in immoral activity. Continue.
Where do we find that the tribe of Levi is greater than that of Simeon? They said, allow him to enter like us. He too is entering to attend to his needs. The pious have permitted.
So they thought that he was now, you know, he was from the tribe of Levi, the grandson of Aaron the Kohen. They thought he was joining the fray. Once he gets in, of course, he pulls out his spear and he kills Zimri and Cosby. Okay, now, let us... All right, text 2b, it gets very graphic. We're going to skip text 2b. Text 2b is the Talmud. It continues. We don't have to read all the gory details. Six miracles that happened in the act of killing Zimri, who was the Jewish prince, and Cosby, who was the Midianite princess. Six miracles that happened. But again, and you can read it if you want, but it's again, it gets very graphic. So the point of this is that this was a statement sin to engage in an immoral activity with an idolatrous nation, an idolatrous woman in a public setting to publicly defy Judaism and Moses and the Jewish people. Upon which Pinchas said to Moses, isn't there a special mitzvah in such a case to go and be zealous? Moses says, indeed, you're right, I forgot. But if you remember it, maybe you'd be the one to do it. And he does it, and that's how it ends. That's how it ends. It's a very strange story on many levels. And we're going to have some very, very... basic questions on the story. Actually, I don't know if it's basic questions, but we have some very important questions on the story. But first, before we get to the questions, let us take a look at text number 3 in the Talmud. Text number 3 talks about how this law, what this law looks like. Again, this is not your run-of-the-mill law. This is a very unique case. We're talking about a public defiance of Jewish law with an with a person from an idolatrous nation, and to specifically thumb the nose at Judaism in a very precarious time. So this is a very specific sin that carries with it a very specific, not officially ordained punishment, but a very specific allowance for an act of zealotry. Does somebody have a question? Did their hand go up? No, I thought I saw a hand. Okay. Text number 3, let's read the Talmud. Ari. Wait, did you just read?
No.
No, okay, Ari.
The Mishnah teaches that one who engages in intercourse with an Aramean woman is among those liable to be killed by zealots.
And 1 second, so the Aramean, the original term is not Gentile, it's Aramean. It's the Abuela Ramis. Aramean is the general term for... you know, somebody from one of the idolatrous nations of ancient times. Continue, please.
Chisa says, concerning one who comes to consult with the court when he sees a Jewish man engaging in intercourse with a Gentile woman, the court does not instruct him that he is permitted to kill a transgressor.
In other words, it's very important. Chisa says that if such a situation were to replicate itself, right, like that unique situation with Pinchas, if that were to replicate itself and someone would come to court and say, what is the halacha, what's the law, the court would not sanction an act of zealotry. The court would not sanction what Pinchas did. This is very important. The court would not say, kill him. It wouldn't. The court does not instruct him that it is permitted to kill the transgressor. Transgressor, continue.
It was also stated that Rabbi Bar Bar Hanna says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, considering one who comes to consult with the court does not instruct him that it is permitted to kill a Jewish man engaged in intercourse with a Gentile woman. Moreover, if Zimri had separated himself from the woman, and only then had Pinchas killed him, Pinchas would have been executed for killing him, because it is permitted for zealots to kill only while a transgressor is engaged in the act of intercourse. Furthermore, if Zimri would have turned and killed Pinchas in self-defense, he would not have been executed for killing him, as Pinchas would have pursued.
Understand what's going on here? It's unbelievable. So we have the Talmud is bringing out the simple point that this is such an anomaly in Jewish law. This is not your average case. The situation that happened, that's told at the end of this week's Torah portion, was a very unique situation that carries with it almost an island of untaught, unspoken, unsanctioned Jewish law that's unofficially okayed. You with me on this? If a certain situation arises... right, the Aramean woman in a public display of defiance, of immorality, etc., leading to, you know, whatever this led to in this case, right? So in that situation, somebody is a zealot and feels strongly about the wrong that's happening, they can take matters into their own hands and kill the perpetrators, but the courts, the rabbis, the legal authorities would never say that they could. But they can, but we're never going to say it. It's halacha ve'emor en kein. It's a halacha, it's a law, but we don't teach it. Now I know what you're thinking. Well, we just taught it. No, we taught that we're not teaching it. Huh? You see how that happened? You see what just happened? We just taught that we don't teach this. So in case a situation arises, you didn't hear it from me. That this is, right. So, but this is a very interesting case, because since when do we encounter a law that you don't teach? Either it's the law or it's not the law. In other words, either it's the law or it's rogue practice and it's against the law. No. So here it's rogue practice, but it's unofficially sanctioned, again, in a very specific scenario. But what's interesting is it's only allowed, again, obviously in this situation, but also only during the act itself. If it would be after the act was concluded, he would be a murderer. Pinchas would be a murderer. If Zimri killed him, Zimri wouldn't be a murderer. He would be acting in self-defense. He's allowed to kill Pinchas for trying to kill him, and even in the act. What else? There's one more wrinkle to this. So, again, only while it's happening, if Zimri had separated, he would have been executed. No, maybe that's it. Okay, so again, so we don't teach it. It has to be during the act, by a zealot, who's carrying out this unofficial form of justice, unofficially sanctioned form of justice. It can't be afterwards, and the one who's potentially getting killed for this is allowed to act in self-defense. You with me on this? None of this makes sense. That's the point. None of this makes sense. That's why I called it the Pinchas paradox. In other words, what we have here is a davar v'hifucho, something and its opposite, which is called a paradox. On the one hand, this situation is stronger, is more severe than any other situation. Because in this case, somebody can actually take laws into their own hands. You don't have, vigilante justice in Judaism. You got to go through courts, and it's a court of law. There's a legal system. It's not like, oh yeah, you see somebody doing something wrong, no problem, take them out. You don't have that, right? There's a system, there's a structure here. With this case, it's such an anomaly. With this case, suddenly vigilante justice, the act of a zealot, is sanctioned. It's sanctioned. Since when? Must be this is stricter, it's stronger than any other case. So on the one hand, it's stronger. Somebody can take justice in their own hands. On the other hand, it's weaker. Because in any other case, after a crime has been committed, you get witnesses, you go to court, and you prosecute. In this case, you can't do anything once it's done. Once it's done, you don't do anything. There's no indication that you go and you charge him and there's no zealotry that can happen afterwards, only during. So during, it's stronger than any case. After, it's weaker than any case. So it's stronger and weaker. What's going on? Makes no sense. This is a paradox. You with me on the questions? Does it make sense? On the one hand, it's the only crime that has a built-in, unofficially sanctioned, right, wink, wink, unofficially sanctioned, zealotry permission, but non-permission. On the one hand, so it's stronger. On the other hand, it's weaker, because afterwards, you can't take this person out. Afterwards, you can't do anything. So what's going on here? What's happening here? You with me on the questions? There's another question. The other question is, what's this whole business of it's the halacha, but we're not going to teach it? What does that mean? Like, what is it, a game? It's like, in other words, this law is not written in Torah. The story is written in Torah, and God kind of sanctions it after the fact, right? This act that happened, this act of zealotry. But we don't find a clear halacha. It's not one of the 613 mitzvot that if this and this happens, that this is what you're supposed to do. It's like, it's the unteachable law. We don't teach it. If somebody comes to court and says, what do we do? The courts will say, there's nothing you can do. That's what the courts will say officially on the record. It's the unspoken law. It's a law that's not clearly written in Torah. And the question is, why? If it's the law that a zealot can take out this person who's committing this terrible sin and bring down the entire nation in a public setting, etc., if that's the ruling, then why isn't it taught? Why isn't it taught? So again, we have the paradox. It's stronger and weaker. And we have the question of why isn't it formally taught? Why is it kind of undercover? Text 4 and text 5 from Maimonides and from the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law. It all just kind of reiterates the laws about this case and what the zealot can do and cannot do. But the point is clear even from the Talmud. The paradox is clear and the point is clear. The point of the question hopefully is clear. And so, therefore, we're up to this point where we need to address this situation. Any questions or comments thus far? Yes?
It seems like maybe they don't teach it because say who's a zealot? What is a zealot, first of all? Who's to say?
Well, I think more people can be zealots if we know that we can be zealots.
What?
More people would be zealots. They're like, oh, okay, I'll be a zealot. I didn't know it was an option. Huh?
It's so dangerous.
Yeah, but it's a very limited case. It's not like, this is not a situation, I mean, come on, this is not a situation that is, I mean, you're going to find an Aramean, you know, nation, right? You're going to find a public setting, you know. This was a major, this was a catastrophe at a very specific moment right in time. So it's not like if you teach this, you're going to have people, like, what is it, Batman? Like, oh, now people are, like, doing their own thing at night. It's not, I mean, it's a very, very unique situation, right? So I hear you, but I don't know. Yeah, but there's so many cases that are unique. Nah, there's a lot of cases. A lot of Jewish law talks about very unique cases. Hey, remember the in Deuteronomy, the rebellious child, the rebellious son, who does certain things, steals money, drinks wine, eats meat, right? And then there's a capital punishment for this, the Ben Sora Murrah, the rebellious son. And the Talmud says, this case never happened, according to one opinion, never happened, never will happen, because the parameters, the contours of this law of who is eligible for this type of violation is so specific. It has to be right before bar mitzvah, a certain age, or maybe right after bar mitzvah, whatever. It's like 6 months, a window in time, either 12 to 12 and a half, or 12 and a half to 13, or 13 to 13 and a half, I forget already, but it's a 6 month window, and the parents have to be identical height and have to have the same voice. It's like a very unique, very, very unique. It's so unique, the way the Talmud describes it, is that in a way that it can never happen. And yet it's taught, it's officially taught. So the fact that this is a rare occurrence, first of all, it happened. Second of all, you know, Torah's not afraid of talking about rare occurrences. So again, the question is what? Are any other questions, comments? Yeah.
My Maimonides seems to say that it is law because it was given to
Yeah, yeah. In other words, what he's saying is that this was transmitted, this was passed down, but it was passed down in an unofficial way of being like, okay, if this were to happen, the zealot would be off the hook, but the zealot has to abide by these certain laws. Like, you have to know when the zealot's gone too far, because if the zealot spears, let's say if Pinchas would have killed them a minute later or 30 seconds later, he would have been up for capital punishment. He would have been a murderer. So you have to, it has to be passed down. Those contours have to be passed down, or else we don't even know what we allow for the zealot, what we disallow for the zealot. So something has to be passed down, but it's not officially taught. In other words, if somebody says, what's the halacha, what's the law if such and such were to happen? Jewish law would say, the courts would say, no, nothing you could do. You know, it's a tragedy. If a zealot would come along and take care of the act, then they might not face a consequence if it was done in the right way. So in a way, it's passed, and that's why I ask: is it passed down or it's not passed down? And if it's passed down, so make it formal. Why is it a game here? Let it be officially sanctioned. But the real question is, and I want to make sure everyone's got it, is the paradox. On the one hand, it's stricter because zealotry is allowed after it happens. On the other hand, it's weaker because you can't do anything afterwards. Okay, so what's going on with this? To understand this, we need to look at what is the meaning of sin in the Jewish understanding. What does it mean that somebody commits a transgression? What is a transgression? What is a sin? An avera? What is it? What does it mean? You're doing something that God doesn't want you to do. Like, what actually happens when a person does a sin, commits a sin? What objectively, spiritually, cosmically happens? So Kabbalah explains that here's what happens. A human being is given a divine energy and life force. We call this loosely the soul. A person has a soul, an energy, a life force that flows through them, animates them, gives them spiritual recognition and cognition, gives them animation, etc. The person has a divine life force flowing through them. When a person uses that life force, that divine life force, their soul, and commits an act that is contrary to God's desire, so which, according to Kabbalah, or in the language of Kabbalah, is that which exists contrary to God's desire, is called Klipa in Sitra Achra. Klipa means shell. Sitra Achra means the other side. So this represents, if you will, the dark side or the negative force in the universe on a cosmic level. When a person engages in sinful actions, acts in a way of transgression, so the, as the Kabbalists explain, they're taking their divine life force and putting it inside a negative space. I don't think it's here. I don't think it's here in text 6a. But one image that he used, that Tanya, the book of Tanya brings, is imagine you have, okay, it gets a little bit graphic. I'll make it, you know, less gross. But imagine you have a bucket filled with waste. I'll let you use your imagination. And then you have the king. You take the king's head. This is not an evil king, right? A king. A good king. Zugesund. The king of kings. And you take the king's head and you put it inside. Right? Put it inside. That's what happens. That's what we do when we commit a transgression. Why? What does it mean? Remember, God gives us a piece of himself, a soul. The neshama is a chelek elokami ma'al mamash. The soul is literally a piece of God. So we have a soul, we have this divine life force, in addition to the fact that aside from the peace of God inside of us, we're connected, as we'll see in text 6a, we're connected with God himself. Forget the peace, which a piece is also the whole, because, right, we know DNA and everything, but even the whole, forget the peace, right? We're connected. So you take yourself and you put yourself in a place of filth. It's not just you, it's not just the body, it's the soul, it's God, etc., that's being moved down into that place, being forced into that place of filth. And that's a very low situation. So again, what is the issue? My kids are... What is the issue with... It's an intended sound, or it's an understandable sound. So that's what happens. Divine energy and life force is being redirected into an unintended place, into a very negative space. So it's really a misappropriation of divine energy and life force. Instead of it going into positive places, a person, through their choice, is redirecting it into a very negative space. Let's read this inside text 6a, Alex. So understand what he just said there. When a person redirects the energy into the negative space, so the negative space, Klipa and Sitra Achra, get divine life force, because a person is feeding that, and then the person gets a chelek barosh, l'chein hu notol chelek barosh, he gets the first piece of that new energy in that dark space. So not only are you feeding this dark force, but you're also taking, gleaning from it as well, the first. And he says, this should be enough to understand the devastation on a spiritual energy level that's happening when a person commits a sin. Continue, please. So again, we're forcing God, so to speak, almost. We, through our choice, forcing God to direct more energy into an evil place. By us feeding that energy, that's the power that we have to take God's energy. God doesn't want that negative element to be energized, but we can do that against God's will. Continue, please.
But when the sinner repents appropriately, he then removes from that
Now this explains what teshuva is based on Kabbalah. Teshuva is tashuv hey. The Hebrew word teshuva can be broken down into two pieces. Tashuv, which means return, and then the last letter is hey. What is the hey? Hey is the Shekhinah. Hey in Kabbalah is the Shekhinah, the divine presence. The lowest emanation of God that fills the world. That's what we are pulling and schlepping and tugging. That's what's in us. That the hey, Malchut, it's very Kabbalistic, but the bottom line is hey is the divine life force and energy that's invested in creation, in us, in our souls, etc. So when we do something, when we commit an act, a sin, that is against God's will, we're taking the hay within us, the hay from God's name, the universal and the particular hay, and we're moving it into a place of darkness and evil and sitra achra and klipa. When we repent, when we do tshuva, tshuva means, not, it doesn't mean repentance, it means literally tush of hay. Take the hay and put it back where it belongs. You know when kids play with toys, right? So you have a shelf. It never happened with me. I'm kidding. You have a shelf and all the toys are organized. Everything is in its right place. And then the afternoon happens. Oh, mazel tov. The next thing you know, everything is everywhere. So then we have an activity called teshuvah. Joking. But, or not. Everything has to go back where it belongs, right? This toy, the cars, the there, the this, the ball's there. Everything has to go back to its place. Teshuvah means, quite simply, returning, restoring the divine presence, God's energy, to its intended place, to its original place with God in a holy space. Right? So you took the energy and you put it into a place that it shouldn't be. Teshuva means reclaiming the energy and moving it back. Make sense? Again, very simply what teshuva, the word means, tashuv, hey, return the hay back to where it belongs. Make sense? How do you do it? How does teshuva happen? Once you put the energy there, how do you pull it back? It seems like, you know, who says you can redeem it? Who says, right? Take a look. Mike, we'll pass the baton. Mike, take a look at text 6b. Tanya continues to explain how this is done.
How is the spirit of Sitra Achra broken? When the heart is broken and contrite, etc. And how is the heart to be broken and humble? It is achieved through being a master of accounting with all the profundity of one's mind. One should concentrate his intellect and understanding deeply for a period every day or at night before Tikkun Chatzos.
That's the midnight prayer of the righteous.
To contemplate how, through his sins, he has brought about the exile of the divine presence, as noted above, and caused his spirit and divine soul to be uprooted from the divine source of all life, and demeaned it to a place of defilement and death, namely, the chambers of the Sitra Achra, his soul becoming a vehicle for them, receiving from them vitality to endow his body.
In other words, he says simply, how do you reclaim the energy? By taking it to heart, by having a broken heart. Contrition and remorse and regret, that's what breaks the hold of the Sitra Achra and allows that energy to flow back up to where it needs to go. In other words, what reclaims the energy? It's not, you don't need a magnifying glass and you don't need some sort of, you know, what am I thinking of? Heat sensitive, no, I don't know, those green goggles that you could see at night, night vision. What are those things that allow you to have vision at night? Oh, night vision. Night vision goggles. You don't need that. You don't need to go in to the dark and dark spaces in the world and try to reclaim energy. It's not a hostage situation. It's by being contrite. It's by regretting what we've done. And this is what the Tikkun Chatzot prayer is all about. It's supposed to take place at the Jewish midnight, which is obviously not 12, because, you know, Jewish time is late. So it's about, well, it depends on the time of year. Sometimes it's around 12, sometimes it's 1 or 1:15. The point is, there's a process in which a person is meant to recount all that they've done, thought about, said, done, that has been negative throughout the previous 24 hours. And in that process, to regret it, to have remorse about it, and to be brokenhearted about it. And that brokenheartedness actually breaks the hold of the Sitra Achra on the energy, because remember, the energy was misappropriated and it's now being held by the this dark force, but by having a broken heart, sincere, right? Being sincere about this broken heart, it's not just a game, then the Sitra Achra itself is broken and the energy flows back up. So that's what tshuva looks like and that's how it's redeemed. Here's the interesting thing. This is, so again, what we've done here is not specific so far to our discussion so far in the previous discussion of this week's Torah portion, the episode at the end. This is a general analysis of what is sin and transgression, what's the problem with it on a cosmic level, what happens on an energy level when we sin, and what teshuva looks like and how it works. This is a very brief Kabbalistic exposition on that topic. Now, there are certain sins, most sins, 99% of sins, are particular, which means that when a person engages in that sin, it's not like the totality of their soul goes into that dark space, a particular part of one's soul, right? The energy in one's hand, the energy in one's mouth, right? Somebody gossips, somebody does something, whatever it is, the energy in the foot, the energy up. So there's a particular energy from a particular part of the soul that animates the body that's going, that's being invested into this dark energy space, right? So it's not the totality of one's soul, and it's not the totality of God, right, that's going into exile. It's being held by Klipa and Sitra Achra. It's a specific, you know, part, piece of the divine light spectrum that's being now held by the dark force. Okay, most sins. There is a particular sin, however, that is not like most sins, and that is the sin of immorality, which is the basic theme of what we're talking about. When it comes to immorality in the realm of intimacy, now we have a much bigger problem. Why? The answer is, because the act of intimacy is not just a particular function of the soul, something that the soul can be involved in, but it rather represents the essence of the soul. Why? Because it's the only action that a person can do that theoretically or conceptually, and I mean that both literally and figuratively, or literally both ways, that conceptually leads to conception. And what is conception? Conception is nothing less than touching on the infinite nature of God and thus the infinite nature of the soul. Everything, every other part of the human being, every part of the body certainly, every other part of the soul, when I say soul, I mean every part of the soul that animates the body is associated with temporal activities, temporary activities. Here and now, it happens and then it ends. The only action, physical action that we can do that has, that touches, that reflects the infinite nature of God is the act of child, of creating a child. Why? Creating life. Because a person can have a child, and that child, please God, can have a child, etc., etc., ad infinitum, right? Until, right? Ain sof, to no end. That, right? Theoretically, right? Obviously, you know, something could happen. It's and individuals might not have children, right? The individual is you know, could go either way. But the point is, in general terms, this intimacy represents the idea of perpetuating the human being, which can keep on going theoretically, right? Or not so theoretically. And that touches on the infinity of God. See, nothing else in this physical universe is forever. Everything is finite. Even human beings, they live and they die. And the things that we do, what we eat, we sleep, our activities, everything is of a finite, temporary nature. It has its time and then it ends. The one thing that we can do that touches on this infinity, this Ein Sofness, this without endness of God is procreation. So when a person engages, and not every act of intimacy leads to literal procreation, but the Kabbalists say that every act of intimacy leads to a spiritual procreation. On a spiritual level, there's life being born. Not in a body, but there's also a life being born on some level. So understand that there's that the notion of this sin that we're talking about, which is Zimri's sin in our Torah portion, is not just a particular sin, but it's rather one. In other words, it's not just a part of the divine energy is now being, is now going into a negative place, but it represents the essence of the soul and the part of the soul that makes the soul divine. Makes the soul divine, that reflects the infinite nature of God. It's the infinite part of the soul that reflects the infinite nature of God that's being invested in this klip and sitra achra. You with me on this? It's not just a sin. It's a very grave act of transgression. So, whereas when it comes to any transgression, the human being is taking a piece of divine energy and putting it into exile. When it comes to an act of immorality in the context of intimacy, it's not taking a piece of divine energy, it's taking a larger, essential aspect of the divine energy, or the soul in particular, and putting it into exile into the klipa sitra achra. Furthermore, when it comes to most sins, as we said in Tanya 6a and 6b, the energy that's being put in klipa sitra achra remains pure, but it's an exile. You notice he used the word exile. It's the exile of Shekhinah. What is exile? Exile means that the individual, let's say an individual, right? My wife just is wrapping up a trip to South Africa. I'm thinking of Nelson Mandela, who was in exile or in prison, right? So you are there, not you. The person is there, but they're in a place that they don't want to be. That's what exile is. Exile is the person is there, but they don't want to be there. If it was up to them, they wouldn't be there. But they have to be there. They're forced to be there. So this is typically any other sin. You take divine energy and you put it in a place where it doesn't want to be. But where it is, what is it? Divine energy. Pure divine energy in a place that it doesn't want to be. Imprisoned against its will. Yes? Until you break it and you release it. However, when it comes to this sin, when it comes to a sin that involves immorality and intimacy, we have a bigger issue, and that is that the energy, again theoretically, physically, but practically, spiritually, creates new life, and that new life takes on its own identity, and it no longer is just energy that's being held somewhere that can be released, but it's actually creating new life, and that new life can't be reclaimed so easily. Are you with me on this? In other words, not only is it taking more and misappropriating it, but as it's being misappropriated, it's actually becoming something else, and that no longer can easily be extracted. You with me? Yes? Yes? Make sense? New life is being born, whether it's physically or spiritually, life that's being born of this illicit union of Zimri and Cosby, right? In our Torah portion. Again, whether it's physical conception or spiritual conception, the bottom line is something new is being produced of this. It's no longer just reclaiming the light and allowing the light to flow back. We have a bigger problem on our hands. Yes? Okay, so now we have all the answers. Now we have all the answers. It's more severe than any other sin, because spiritually, it's more severe. There's more of the essence of the divine energy that's being misappropriated, and it's being misappropriated in a way that it cannot be extracted. It's finished. It's gone. Once it's done, it's done. It can't ever be extracted. It can't be extracted any more than you can extract. Let's say it leads to a literal child. Let's say they had a child from this. Like you couldn't literally extract the child from this world. You can't extract that energy from this world, from its place, right? And again, spiritually also, because every physical union produces a spiritual birth. So on a spiritual level, spiritually, within Klip and Sitra Achra, right, within the negative force, there's also something being born. That, again, cannot be extracted. So now we understand why it's much more severe than other transgressions mentioned in Torah. And this produces a paradox. What's the paradox? We'll start with the second half. After it's done, there's nothing you can do. Remember? After it's done, there's nothing you can do. It's done. Every sin in Torah has a consequence, except for this one. After the fact, go to court, what are you going to do? It's finished. Every consequence in Torah represents a reclamation of the energy. In this case, you can't reclaim the energy once it's done. So go to court, bring witnesses. What are you going to do? It's done. It's finished. It's finished. You've taken the light, the divine light, the divine energy and life force, and you put it somewhere, you created something, and now it's, what are you going to do? Uncreate it. It's done. It's finished. If it's still laying in exile, laying in wait, so we can break it, and every punishment in Torah is breaking of the klipa to allow it to allow the energy to go back, to return. But if you've already created something, so now what? There's nothing that can be done. Because it's... Are you with me on this? Is it making any sense? Ish? Sort of? Ish? Making sense? Ish? Yeah? Once it's done, once the energy is done, once the energy has been transformed into a new creation, whether physically or spiritually, so you can't reclaim it. So after it's done, it's weaker. After it's done, you can't kill this person. Why are you killing this person? To reclaim the light? You can't reclaim the light. If Pinchas would have waited until Zimri and Cosby were finished conceiving, whether physically or spiritually, and then he would have killed them, he would have been a murderer. Why? Because why are you killing them now? To reclaim the light? You can't reclaim the light. It's finished. So why did you kill them? You're stamma murderer. You can't kill them. But during the act itself, before the act is consummated, halacha unofficially sanctions an act of zealotry that we don't find in any other case. To stop the light from taking a new form, from taking a new form of life in a negative, in a dark place, the Torah says somebody who's a zealot can go ahead. But if it's so important to stop this before it happens, why is it a law that only a zealot can do unofficially? Because Torah speaks of reclamation. Torah speaks of standard cases where the light goes into klipa and there's a way to break it and let it go. In this case, it's a non-standard case. This is a non-standard case of sin. This is a case where the light is going to be so transformed to evil, to darkness, that it can never be reclaimed. In such a case, the Torah says, you know what? There's nothing we can say about this whole case. This whole scenario, this whole Zimri Cosby fiasco, this public display of immorality in a sense, in the context of intimacy, producing life, in this whole case, there's nothing that Torah can say on the matter. There's nothing. Because Torah talks about light in good places. It talks about light in not good places. And light in not in good places, how to reclaim that light. Mitzvah, transgression, and shuvah. That's what Torah talks about. Torah does not speak about situations where the light is lost forever. It doesn't. It's beyond Torah's discussion. When it comes to that, you can't reclaim it. Beforehand, the Torah is not going to tell you to stop. I mean, there's the Torah, this whole scenario, Torah doesn't deal with. So for the zealot, we have a tradition. If the zealot takes care of things, we're not going to prosecute the zealot. But what to do about it, there's nothing you can do. Make sense? Yes? Just pretend like it makes sense. We can always explain after the class. We have to officially close it out. In the final analysis, what we've learned today, hopefully, is the following. Number one, every mitzvah, I didn't mention this before, but I'm mentioning it now. So this is what we learned today. Number one, every mitzvah takes light and puts it in a positive place. Every sin takes divine light within and without and puts it into a negative place. 99.9% of sins can be rectified. And what does it mean that it's rectified? This is tshuva. What it means is, the light that was put in a dark place can be reclaimed by breaking the hold of that dark place, beginning with the hold inside. A broken heart, a lev and nishbar, a broken and crushed heart, allows the light to return back to where it needs to go. The vessel only holds it as long as the vessel is intact. When you break the vessel, starting from inside one's own heart, when you break the heart, when there's genuine remorse for what was done, that breaks the vessel, breaks the hold on the light, and the light returns back to where it needs to go. 99% of sins are like that. That's what a mitzvah is, that's what an avera is, and that's what tshuva is. Then you have a very unique situation, where the sin is not just taking a piece of light or a limited part of light and putting it into a dark place, but it's taking the totality of the light, so to speak, and putting it into a dark place. And not only is it now an exile in a dark place, but it now becomes something new. The light now has become born as something else. And now you can't undo that. You can't pull out that light any more than you can pull out a child that's born from the earth. I mean, I guess theoretically you can, but we're not talking about that, right? So you can't pull that out. So there's certain situations, again, with this case of immorality, where that light cannot be reclaimed. There's no tshuva for that. The light can't be reclaimed. In such a situation, again, in a very specific, narrow situation. So, number one, the Torah says that there's no consequence after the fact, because what are you going to do? You know, what are you going to? There's no reclamation of the light. Is it? Even the recap is depressing. Oh, I thought it was going to be like fun games. No, I'm kidding. But we'll just recap, and then we'll walk away hopefully with a lesson that at least we can take to heart practically. So there can't be an act of reclamation. But during the act, again, we have this very unusual allowance for, unofficial allowance for the act of zealotry to stop it from happening, or to stop it from being consummated and actually fully happening. And in that way, the action is stopped. But it's not something that Torah officially talks about, because again, Torah speaks about typical cases of light that can be reclaimed. Okay. So that's it. So what's the takeaway? That's a recap of what we talked about concept-wise, and it answers all the questions. So this sin is stronger and it's weaker at the same time, because it's so different, and it's not talked about officially in Torah because, again, it's very unique and it's different. What's the practical takeaway? Number one, our actions matter. What we do has an impact, even if we don't feel it. We sometimes tell ourselves, what difference does it make if I do this or don't do that? If I gossip to my friend or I don't gossip to my friend, lashon hara is always low-hanging fruit, so you know, it's always kind of safe because, you know, whatever. By the way, did you guys hear about joking? That would be gossiping. See? Okay, so gossip is very low-hanging fruit, so the point is like this. We have a choice to put our energy in a holy place, put our energy in a negative place. At the same time, we should not be despondent. We should know that even if we've done things that are not so, you know, that we're not so happy about, not so thrilled about, not so proud about, you can always reclaim the light. Process, and it begins with being with contrition. Begins with simply regretting what was done. And that act of simple regretting, the act of contrition, is enough, according to Kabbalah, to break the stronghold, of Klipa Sotrachra and release the light. That is the positive takeaway. Number one, our actions matter. And number two, there's always hope. Yeah, Zimri and Cosby and Pinchas have their episode, but at least these are the lessons that we can take for us. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for this episode of Torah Studies.